Can I just welcome everybody to today's Weber Training teleclass? We're really, really thrilled to have Dame Christine Beasley joining us. As we all know, in the field of infection prevention and control, she has the overall national responsibility for taking all these initiatives that are coming out of the Department of Health and everywhere else, it seems, forward. And Christine has agreed to do a teleclass for us today, really to update us on progress to date. I hope there'll be time for questions at the end, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
But as soon as we get started, then the more time we'll have for questions. So I'll hand over to Dame Christine Beasley. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Yes, I'll certainly get through the presentation so there's time for questions or discussion, because I'm sure that's as valuable as what I'm going to say. As you say, I'm just going to share the progress that we've made nationally, I guess, since we last had the telecast conference, describe really how we've made that progress, share features of how the different organisations have made progress, and just identify the things that we now know drive improvement. So that's what I'll cover today. Just sort of starting with the where we've got to with reducing, first of all, MRSA and then Clostridium difficile. We've made, and the NHS has made, more to the point, really impressive progress in reducing MRSA and indeed C. difficile. I mean, at the start of the target, which was nearly 4 years ago now, just over three when we actually started in terms of starting the target, but in the run-up to it, there was a lot of cynicism and a belief, I think, for many people that this was totally unachievable. And I think one of the great improvements is that 3 years later, there's been a real strong change in attitude. I mean, so much known now that people say to me, oh, perhaps you could have made that target tougher. So it's amazing how things change. And it has been achieved with absolutely a major effort in every level of the NHS. I guess since the slides were done, we've had the reports last week of the quarterly data that is the end of 2007, so January to March 2007. Most of you will know that we are measuring our reduction in MRSA bacteremias for the first quarter this year, April to June 08, with the first quarter 3 years ago. The overall reduction that we made at the end of 2007 was 49% in bacteremias, and we are absolutely well on target to meet, if not exceed, the 50% reduction in the MRSA bacteremia. So that's just sort of fantastic news. And we're not at all complacent about that. We need to go further, and many organisations are pushing with that. I think it is true to say that, you know, that's the national picture. And it does hide variation. There are still some organisations that could be doing a lot better, and there are others that are right ahead of the field, and perhaps we'll touch on that later. In terms of Clostridium difficile, again, a big reduction in terms of, because we're only just starting to count in terms of over 65, in terms of under 65, that's only a relatively new number. But for those people over 65, in the quarter January to March of 08, we had a 32% reduction in C. difficile infections compared to the same quarter in the year previously. So we are making big inroads, but it is only at the beginning of this reduction. We know, because we know from experience with MRSA, that we will get quite a good reduction to begin with, probably, and then we will sort of hit the really difficult areas. So we know we've got a lot more to do around C. difficile, but certainly both going absolutely in the right direction. I guess looking back, so that we think about, you know, where have we come from in order to help us as we move forward, I think it's important to understand something of how we got to the point where infection has become such a major issue. And the reality is that there were probably a few major efforts that combined to mean that infection just wasn't considered an issue in many organisations. Some of that was about infection being the domain of infection control teams. Some of it was a sort of belief that, well, infection happens. Certainly, as far as C. diff was concerned, there was an overuse and sometimes inappropriate use of antibiotics. There was a sort of lack of recognition of the impact that these infections have on both the quality and the productivity of care. So the amount of extra resource it clearly costs you as an organisation. Typically, people with MRSA stay in hospital at least another 10 days, and for people with C. diff, often 21 days. You can imagine what that means in terms of your flexibility as well as the cost to your organisation. And certainly, much of the training was not focused on infection control. In fact, some of the elements, the practical elements of infection control training, sort of fell out of both undergraduate pre-registration and postgraduate education. And I guess a belief, too, from some managers that it was a clinical issue. So we've certainly, as we look back, we recognise where we've come from, and recognising that to reduce HCI does require a major cultural, organisational and behavioural change. You know, there isn't just, as ever, a magic bullet around that. I guess our strategy in England has been, and you will probably remember this if you've been on the telecast before, 4 years ago when I was appointed to this post, I took responsibility for it. The government and indeed my then boss was very keen to have a high profile national leader to give real focus to this being a number one priority, and there was an enormous amount of commitment from the government. We had a target, we had a national board, in fact we still have, of key senior stakeholders across the spectrum. We've introduced legislation in terms of the Hygiene Bill Code. We've absolutely stepped up a pace the regulation through the Healthcare Commission. We've spent a lot of time on visits, conferences across the country, and we've had a very clear communication strategy. So we've had over the last few years to help us get and to support the NHS to make the improvement I've described. We've had a multifaceted strategy to get us there. So I guess some of the action that's helped us get there. I think if you put infection sort of in the middle of the slide, as it is, the four areas that we know have really mattered in no particular order have really helped. Certainly there was a need to build knowledge of improvement science into the system. So, you know, a knowledge of spread, adoption, sustainability, reliability, some of the things that are there on the slide. Very important that people understood that. Many people still didn't. That was particularly true of infection control teams because they'd not really been exposed to improvement science. We definitely needed to make sure we had strong performance management. So I've worked very closely here with my colleagues in performance management through the strategic health authorities around how targets make organisations and boards really focus and how it's important to get management attention, and we could go into that and how we've actually done that in questions if that's of interest. It's helped to have the targeted support, and I'll say more about the improvement teams later on. Bringing a fresh pair of eyes into an organisation to work alongside people really helps people to focus on where they'll get their biggest gain, because one of the problems is that you can do lots of things in this area and you can dissipate effort and actually move forward in only a very small way. We knew that to achieve the target and go beyond it, we needed to really focus effort. And then some of the other levers that have been in our system in England in terms of patient choice, this is often, if you ask patients, and we do frequently through Mori and Ipsos polls, infection is still a big issue for patients in terms of their choice of hospitals, particularly around elective care. We've had changes to regulation in terms of, and I've spoken a little about the Healthcare Commission and the focus they've put on it. Commissioning, again, a big improvement in commissioning, starting to think about how do they commission for quality, and clearly infection or the lack of it is a big issue in terms of how they start to commission services. We've worked very closely with Monitor, the organisation, if you like, that supports and regulates foundation trusts, who've been very supportive in terms of foundation trust applications and looking at the infection rates in those hospitals and seeing whether, you know, they're of a level that would support FT application. And indeed, some of the issues are, as I've discussed before, around money. So all of those areas, the improvement science, performance management, using the levers you've got and the targeted support, all need to be pulled into play if you're to make the sorts of inroads I believe that we've made. Early on, we met with lots of people in the health service, some who were experts in infection control, others who were experts in running their hospitals or their healthcare settings. And what they were desperate for was some focused tools and advice. There was so much around, and they absolutely didn't want guidance. What they wanted was tools that would help them. So early on, Saving Lives was one of our early products, if you like, as we worked with the NHS on what was there. We pulled together all the available evidence, and as ever, when you actually look at it, some of the evidence is very variable around what you do. We tried to design the tool in a way that would help trusts look at their baseline, help them to have a sort of traffic light approach to what they were doing so they could prioritise, and help them to develop their improvement plans. And we looked at the high impact interventions that we knew produced an impact. We knew that if you got reliability in these clinical procedures, lines, wounds, catheters, all of those areas, then we knew that this would have an impact. And so we pulled that together, and that was one of our first products in terms of supporting the NHS around the tools and advice they were asking for. We then went on to set up a national improvement team, which we still have. This team in many ways is a virtual team. There are one or two people, obviously, who are running it who are full-time. But actually, and the team really has a sponsoring director with a microbiologist and infection control nurse, some input from pharmacy and facilities, and they are supported by a program manager. But many of these people are working in their own organizations, and they give sessional time, which we pay for, to help them go into organizations, look at what the diagnosis of the problem is, and then we put in the support that is required in a range of different packages. And the team start off by looking at and doing a diagnostic review. They look at the data, talk to staff, they do a lot of observations, they provide a report for the chief exec with recommendations, and then from that the trusts themselves develop their own delivery plan, and the team provides the ongoing support as required over sort of time limited periods. And to date we've worked with 130 trusts in this way, and we've had very, very good feedback from trusts saying this support has really helped them, because it's sort of real people doing the real job in real organisations, so they can absolutely support organisations to make the changes that they need. So that was a quick canter from where we've come from, as it were, and let's move on to, so what have we learned from all of that? What do we know works now after really sort of 3 years of working towards the target on MRSA and a little less time with C. diff, and the sort of year we had as the run-up to the target, so what we've learnt. And I think we usually sum it up, or I do, around this sort of power of three. It is really important that organisations really believe it's possible to make major reductions, not a belief that they can do something around the edges. They need a belief that it is possible, and they need to use the language that reinforces that belief, because it's key in the organisational effort. When we started, there was from almost everybody a sort of view that this was impossible, and they talked the language of this is impossible, and they wanted to spend all their time trying to convince me it was impossible, and not surprisingly for those organisations it became impossible at the beginning. But we know now that from people who had that strong belief, we've worked with trusts that have had 60-plus MRSA bacteremias that we've reduced to 15. Many trusts have achieved over their 50% reduction. We've got a lot of trusts that are going for a sort of zero tolerance. We've got one healthcare community with the acute trust, primary care homes, who are making a commitment to have significant reductions in their whole health community around a range of infections. So we have many people have now really aspirational belief. So you do need to have belief. You definitely need to think about how you help and support change in behaviour, because delivery of real improvement requires significant behaviour change. It requires all the things that people often want to argue with you around: hand hygiene, your dress codes, how you re-examine your own personal practice, developing a mindset that recognizing that reducing infection is everyone's responsibility and that I, whoever I am in the organization, have a part to play. There is a very big behavioral change that you can see in organizations that are really, really making improvements in this area. And finally, I guess the third B is the be sure bit. Putting policies and procedures in place will not deliver the improvement. It will only happen if you can really be sure that staff are compliant. And you'll only know this if you have mechanisms to assure yourself that this is the case. It is really important. We found that many organizations believed and genuinely believed, having put quite a lot of effort in, that what they thought was happening. But actually, when they really began to look, and particularly using some sort of independent observational techniques, they found that they were far, far away from their aspiration. So we've certainly learned that the approach of, you know, believe in it, know you've got to make a significant behavior change, and be sure that what you think is happening is really happening, are the sort of bedrocks of what we've learned. So while some still struggling, and indeed they are, although it's, as I say, it's been very good progress over 3 years, there are sharp contrasts between those who've made huge improvements and those who have not. And that's not down to caseload mix or any of those sorts of things. It's down to some of the things I've already said. So those trusts that are still struggling, as I say, have a belief system that still believes it's not possible. They're still arguing about the target being unfair, which is, national targets by their definition are always rather difficult and rather crude. And they're arguing about that rather than thinking what we're talking about here is not a target, but the numbers of patients who, if they get infections, are often very ill, have significant morbidity, and in some cases die. It's not part of their strategic intention or perceived by staff as a priority. It's still seen as something they'll do when they've done the rest of the job, and that's very much linked with senior leadership not having properly gripped the agenda. They do have implementation plans, but often not without very, very clear stated outcomes, timescales, who's in the lead, what the outputs are. It's still pretty hazy. And critically, they haven't devolved the accountability. In some organizations, there's still heavy reliance on the infection control team to sort it out. Within these organizations, there are few consequences for non-compliance. They don't pick up the benefits of root cause analysis, and the infection control team is not out there. They've not rethought their roles and rethought how it might be different. So those are the characteristics why some trusts are still struggling, and we are working with those clearly now as a matter of urgency. And the flip side is, well, the features of successful organizations, and you've got some of them there, clearly they're the flip side of, you know, the belief system. Many successful organizations have got a zero tolerance philosophy. They have lead champions by the chief executive and the executives on the board. They link healthcare associated infections with quality, effectiveness, and efficiency. They have core values often, which is their core value of their organization is to reduce harm. They have very high profile microbiologists and a very, very good and effective infection prevention team. They have an understanding of the issues for their organization. So what are the key issues for their organizations around infection? Obviously, there are some core issues, but there are different issues depending on where you are. They use data. One of the real startling differences between organizations and increasingly health economies that are beginning to make progress are the ones that know their data, use it, and use it well down into the organization. So when I go to organizations where they've got a grip and a focus and a pace on it, nurses, doctors, managers can talk me through the data as though it was, you know, the weather forecast really, or probably better than that, because they understand the data and they respond to it. They learn from every case, and they critically have clear accountability with consequences at every level. So some of the organizations have got it into consultants' appraisal, it's into their HR policies, it's into a whole range of areas. It's taken seriously. I guess when we look at clinical practice, as I've said about when I talked about be sure, there's a lot of rose-tinted glasses when people look at compliance data, and they think that a lot of things are happening around compliance when it isn't. There's often a mismatch between intention and action. And when the improvement team set up a program, when we were asked to help in this area by some trusts, the observation, they were called the observation of care teams, they were offered to trusts, and what the majority of the reviews showed was the difference between the compliance data the trusts were declaring and what was observed by the team. It reinforced the need that staff who are doing reviews need training, they need to be competent to undertake the techniques, that peer observation may offer greater rigour than their own staff undertaking it, and that spot audits are probably more revealing than regular planned ones. It really is important to look at the compliance area and to think about how you can be sure that it's really working in clinical practice. So I guess in terms of the headlines, as ever, as I say, there are no quick fixes to reducing infection. It's a really hard slog, and certainly as far as I'm concerned, over the last 3 or 4 years, there have been days when I too have thought we'll never get there, this is such an uphill struggle, and we're going backwards rather than forwards. So it's sort of hard work to change the sort of culture within something as big as the NHS. But we certainly know the things that make the biggest impact. On MRSA, we know that hand hygiene, that screening and decolonization, that paying real attention to indwelling devices and reducing them as far as you possibly can, making sure that wound care is critical, and some linkage around antibiotics. Certainly for C. diff, we know that hand washing, as we know before, was critical, that actually at the beginning you can make such big inroads into C. difficile if you both develop and police and rigorously enforce a clear antibiotic policy within the hospital, but also paying attention to antibiotics that are prescribed in the community. Prompt isolation is critical with C. diff, and cleaning has a much bigger impact. As we know, the spores live much longer for C. diff, and really effective cleaning makes a big impact. So some of the things are the same for all infections, and some clearly there are some differences. So for a whole organisation who sustain, not just manage to hit improvements and keep it there, but really make the significant and sustainable changes that keep them month on month without any MRSA bacteremia, reducing C. diff and really beginning to succeed in this area. It's the journey as described there, really. You do need a clear vision about what you're doing. Leadership throughout the organisation is critical, both clinical and managerial leadership. Accountability has to be clear and it has to bite. You have to be really sure that people have got the competence to do what they're doing. And that's sort of quite interesting because there are still quite a few clinical people whose knowledge, understandably, of infection is not at the highest level. And they sometimes feel very embarrassed about asking and saying, actually, I don't know about that. What's the impact of that? And you have to find ways of making sure people could do that in a safe environment, not feeling, you know, embarrassed and belittled by it. Measurement is critical. If you're not measuring what you're doing, there is absolutely no way of knowing how you're progressing. As I say, the data is critical. And then how you assure yourself of all that's happening is part of that journey. And then, you know, it is a continuous journey as you continually move yourself to higher and higher aspirations. So just touching on those areas as we go on that journey. The clear vision, I think, is absolutely linked to a trust intention to be absolutely clear that their remit, as well as to make the money balance and hit the activity targets and all those other things, is to do it in the context of delivering constantly improving quality and safety. You know, it's not either or, it's about both. It's a vision that has zero tolerance, that believes that they can get to a point where they will have no avoidable infections, and they are rigorous about it. Where they have real ambition and stretch, that they're not just pushing against something that's easy to achieve, where they genuinely understand that a patient who comes into our care for some surgery or care or intervention because they're very sick, if we end up then giving them an infection, it's a sort of final insult on a journey that our patients shouldn't experience. And that most of all, they have focus, pace and grip that surrounds their vision. We've touched on leadership in some of the other areas. Clearly the board and the chief exec is absolutely critical. The medical and nurse directors have a very, very key role to play, and they need to have time. One of the other things we find in organisations are struggling, that you'll have the medical director or the nurse director who is the lead in the trust, but when you actually speak to them about, you know, how much time they're devoting to it, it's hardly anything, because they're also responsible for 1,000 other things. And although people have paid lip service to their leadership, they've not made it possible for them to devote real time. This requires real time and very specific time if you're the leader within the organisation. Implementation needs to be, you need an implementation lead for your delivery plan. You know, however good your director is, how much time they're putting into it. I can speak here for me in the department. You know, I put a lot of time and effort into this area, but I have other things to do as well. Without Janice Stevens, who is my director, who is absolutely responsible for running this program, we would be nowhere, because there would be nowhere that I could give the focus, pace and detailed leadership it requires, and that's true within an organization. You need champions, people that are absolutely enthusiastic about what you're doing, from a range of people, professions, managers and throughout the organization. And you need to move away from sort of infection control committees, which can sometimes feel like the hand of death, to an infection prevention board, where people are not thinking about control but are thinking about prevention. Not thinking that infection is inevitable, but actually how do we prevent it happening in the first place, and getting the focus shifted. Accountability, again key, that all staff know what's expected of them, they will be held to account. And that they will have the authority and responsibility. We've done an awful lot of work around trying to make sure that staff that are closest to patient care have the authority to make the changes that they need, and don't think they're part of a system whereby they either have to push everything up, or if they do make decisions, nothing happens. The organisations have to wrap themselves around the frontline staff to make sure they can make the decisions around improvement, and that they are then held to account for what they are doing. It means that you need very practical things like, you know, HR friendship in job descriptions, in personal objectives. It's discussed at people's appraisal, certainly discussed at mine. The consequences of non-delivery are understood, that there are rewards and incentives, and that you absolutely look at, you observe and you feed back to people how they're exercising that accountability. So it's it needs to be very, very clear and very focused, and staff need support and training. They need to be sort of liberated to make the decisions, and then it's absolutely appropriate they should then be held to account for the work that goes on in their areas. Competence is an issue I've just talked about. Training, it needs to go through a whole range of things, as I said here, induction, mandatory updates, and it needs to be delivered in different ways. You know, it's no good just having an e-learning program across the organization. That may not suit some people in some areas. You need to make sure that the modes of delivery are suitable, and they need to range from e-learning to more traditional methods to a whole range of different areas to make sure, different approaches to make sure you're touching all your staff in the best way possible to help them learn. The infection prevention team needs to be given a lot of support, and so does the DIPSI and the organisations. And as I say, just don't assume competence. You need to check that staff still have the skills around aseptic technique, inserting lines, wound care. You know, often staff feel very embarrassed to say, I'm not sure my skills are up to it. They often won't say. You need to have ways of assessing people's competence to make absolutely certain they're competent in those areas. And then you need to be able to measure. the key performance indicators need to be at board and directorate level, and they need to be constantly reviewed to make sure they're stretching and that they're real, that you look at compliance data. We've talked about root cause analysis, that you make links to other clinical indicators like mortality rates and outcome measures, and you change your culture through the language that you use. And information, as I say, needs to be very visual, and you need to track changes visually. People that are making big impacts in this area have got the information up on their ward boards. You know, patients see it. They talk about it. It's part of their team meetings, part of the multidisciplinary team. It's live and it's real. And if they see that their data is going in the wrong direction, then they're the very first to say, you know, what do we need to do about it? What's happening? How do we get ourselves back on track? You need to make sure that you're sure that all your systems are working, that both the people and policies are operating in an effective way. It's absolutely integral to risk and clinical governance. You need to be clear about the risk to your business as well as to patients, and you need to have effective systems in place to improve reliability. So an awful lot we've learned in terms of what we know makes sense. There are lots of there are several new tools that we launched at the NHS Confederation last month, responding to the NHS saying actually we need to other support. So the board to ward, which is helping you make sure that there are that you've really got accountability through your organisation with case studies of organisations that are doing it really well. Going further faster, which is how do you reduce HCI and improve cleanliness, and it's our second edition of that, picking up really what we've learned from organisations, and an updated root cause analysis package to enable staff to really benefit from good and powerful root cause analysis. All of that we launched in June at the Confederation. I'm sure you're aware we've got a website, www.cleansafecare.nhsuk, where you can get involved, where you can pick up case studies. There are forums online. So if you want more information, then you know, the Safe Clean Care website will have it for you. And we've even begun to see some changes in some of the media headlines. There's a pretty big time lag when you make changes in the NHS. Some of you will remember that when we made lots of changes around waiting and A&E, it took a long time for the media to catch up on it. That will be certainly true around infections, but we have begun to get some headlines like this, you know, hospitals winning war on superbugs, numbers fall at hospitals, particularly in the local media, and even in the national media. We're beginning to get a little bit of a shift to say this feels like it's going in the right direction. So a long way to go, but beginning to get the shift. So what have we achieved in the last 3 years? We've certainly, I think, improved the profile of importance of HCI. It's never been higher. People talk infection, think about infection, understand that what it means for patients. And I think if any of you have ever looked after somebody that has had MRSA bacteremia or indeed Clostridium difficile or have a relative, you know that it isn't just a little infection, that C. diff isn't just a little bout of diarrhea. It is a devastating impact on people who almost inevitably are already sick and are often elderly, not exclusively, but often they are. And it is a real impact on them. And the idea that we should have a view that says infection just happens, faced with what that means to our patients, just seems to me inconceivable. And we've absolutely got the profile up there in terms of what needs to happen. And organisations recognise that how they deal with infection is very, very linked to their reputation. We've certainly got a requirement through the organisation to reduce HCI, and it's now in, we've now got statutory support for that. Cleanliness continues to improve. We haven't forgotten about cleanliness. I say so many times, it's not that it has in some ways the biggest impact on infection, although it does on C. diff, but it is the touchstone with which our patients, I think, quite rightly look at us and say, are we taking infection control seriously? That continues to improve. The latest PEAT scores showed about a 92% satisfaction on cleanliness, either at the good or the excellent level. Clearly, we want to move everything up to excellent. It isn't that we haven't still got a way to go, but we've come a long way in the last few years. I think across the piece, people recognise that that infection is everybody's responsibility. The language of zero tolerance is emerging. It's certainly not everywhere, but it's emerging. I am very confident that we will hit the MRSA figures. They'll be announced in the autumn for our first quarter of this year, which is our target quarter. And we know we've stopped C. diff numbers rising. We've got early signs of good improvement, but we know we've got a long way to go with that. So there's been a huge achievement, not from me, but from people in the NHS who've picked this up and said this is really, really important. And nurses, doctors, other staff, managers have really put effort into making a difference for patients. Final slide from me. As I say, this isn't a sprint, but it's a long journey. It's certainly a marathon. It has lots of ups and downs in all of it, and it will continue to do there. We are absolutely clear that as we go through the C. diff target in the next 3 years, and we still maintain that as a national target, but MRSA becomes a local target, that we maintain the pressure for that to be a real stretch target, and we get to the point after the next 3 or 4 years where absolutely embedded into the psyche of the NHS and the culture of the NHS is that, you know, infection is something that we don't do here. We keep it down to the absolute minimum, so that, you know, that becomes, you know, the sustainable improvement around patient safety. So we know we've still got more to do, and we need to make the journey because, frankly, our patients deserve nothing less. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for an interesting presentation. It seems as if we have lost Maria and her colleagues down south. They did say that they had some technical difficulties earlier on.
No problem.
Excellent presentation. Thank you very much. It's always good to have you to join us. As we have a few minutes, and if you still have some time,
I do, yes.
Then we'll open the floor up to questions. Paul, if you can remove mute for us, that would be great.
Christine, I'm really interested to hear that we're looking at more stretch targets.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the C. diff target that's been set is based on activity and rates, which I think is really helpful because it helps us all drive down to the lowest possible rate.
Yeah.
Do you think that would be the right approach for the future with MRSA?
Yes, I do. I mean, we know that when we set the MRSA target, it was pretty crude. And we'd never done anything like this before, so it was quite difficult to do. What we really want to do is to get local targets to be, as you say, absolutely stretching and really sort of ambitious, but related in a way that I think is a bit more sophisticated than we've had with MRSA. I mean, we just have to be careful. The numbers around MRSA are so small. We just need to make sure that we, you know, we get that right.
Thank you. That's really helpful because I think our local view is that we want to just drive our rate down as low as we
exactly
can.
Right, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Debbie.
That's a pleasure, Tracy.
I'll pick mine up unless yeah. anybody else wants to jump in. Obviously, we talk about acute trusts rates, but obviously now with the new vital signs, there are the population targets
yeah.
that primary care trusts are expected to meet. I just wondered what your thoughts are around this in terms of achievement. I mean, we're very much following the positive messages that you're saying as we will achieve this.
Yeah.
But obviously, there are additional complicating factors in so much as there are so many that we can, through root cause analysis of the pre-48-hour ones and the ones coming from GP specimens. But I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of collaboration with acute trusts, particularly in some occasions foundation trusts, where the numbers, they're reducing their numbers, but when are we going to get to that point that, you know, it stops still becoming responsibility of PCTs and of acute, that really it's all together and...
Yeah.
There's still the segregation, isn't there?
I mean, there are two things, I think. There's something about how we collect the data, which can sometimes, and as you know, with C. diff, we're matching that to PCT, so trying to get away from just organisational targets, and that has its own challenges just technically, but you know that we definitely know that we need to do that, because sometimes the way you collect the data sort of drives the behavior, really, doesn't it, in terms of how people behave. And absolutely the next, I think, phase of this journey is around, if you like, a whole health economy approach, you know, and that, for example, that's what's happening in Wolverhampton, where the hospital, the PCTs, the care homes are coming together to say, what do we do together for this whole health community? You know, how are we going to, so that we all own our part of it, and we're, but we're clear about what we're accountable for. Now, in some ways, I'm not suggesting it's easy in Wolverhampton, but in some areas where you've got one hospital and a PCT and a sort of defined community, it might be easier than if you're in the middle of Manchester or London or wherever. But nevertheless, I think you can start to carve out your community. And it feels to me that that is exactly, you know, the next stage of this journey, really, so that you actually both provide the safest care in terms and use all the things you need to do that. And also you commission, your commissioning plan, you know, drives that. So that, that I think is the next stage of this, that we would certainly not have been able to start with that 3 years ago. It would have been far too complex and ambitious. But I think that's where we should be heading.
That's lovely. Thank you very much. That's very reassuring, because that's the way we're trying to do it locally. So it's good to know that we're kind of along the same lines.
Yeah.
So that's brilliant. So thank Christine again for
her
time.
Very good. Thank you.
And I hope we'll probably call on you again in the future as we all progress down this journey. And maybe this time next year we'll be talking more about primary care trusts and the commissioning, the commissioning solutions. So thank you very much for your time. I'll just say thank you to everyone that's attended today.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.